الحمد لله رب العالمين فارئنا الصلاة والمعين الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين المبعوث رحمة للعالمين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد بيته الأطيبين الأطهرين الهداة المهديين ورحمة الله على أعدائهم إلى قيام يوم الدين رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي أما بعد. Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. InshaAllah, the topic that we will be looking at in our session tonight is how we as Muslims should deal with and should understand and confront with the challenges of modernity. Now, I don't want to look at this from a very academic or purely an intellectual perspective. What I want to focus on is certain aspects of society that have come into prominence since the Enlightenment, since the advent of modernity in Europe and in, quote unquote, the New World, and which have influenced and affected Muslims as individuals and Muslim societies as a whole. The challenge that I want us to keep in mind is how it is that we can go through our lives understanding, developing, and strengthening our Islamic identity, and also deriving insight and certainty into what we are to do as Muslims, or what our priorities or what our goals should be when we live in a society where many of the traditional sources of support or strength for our religious practice and our religious identity are absent. Was it easier to be a Muslim in a pre-industrial or a pre-modern society? We might have different answers to that question, thank you. But in some ways, I don't want to try to answer it universally. In some ways, it certainly was easier. People's lives were not governed by smartphones, watches, time. We didn't have artificial lighting, or our ancestors didn't. And so their day would generally follow the natural patterns and rhythms of light, daylight, and nightfall. The timings for the five daily prayers, and not just the five daily prayers, even the night prayers, Salatul Layl, made sense. A person might not want to pray. That person might not have the willpower or the desire to pray. That comes from within the person, within our intentions, within our soul. But the way our lives work today, even if we have that desire, sometimes we ourselves will find it difficult. Our lives, our commitments, our obligations, they make it difficult for us to fall asleep early enough to even be able to think about waking up for the night prayer with ease, whether or not we may be inclined to actually pray. And the daily prayers as a whole, they follow the same basic pattern. Not only with prayer, but as we will talk about, many aspects of our identity, our values, they have been challenged by the changes that have taken place within society over the last 150, 200, 300 years, in some parts of the world, in some parts of the Muslim world earlier. In some parts, it's a very recent change that has taken place. What's interesting to us, what's important to us immediately, is to develop a way of responding to those challenges, a way of prioritizing what we should be studying, what we should be thinking about, and what we should be doing in order to undo some of the damaging effects of the way that society currently operates. Now, inshallah, we will have ample time for your comments and for any questions that there might be. But I want to lay the groundwork, so to speak, by talking about a few specific challenges that are presented by modernity, by our society and culture which we live in, which is a part of us, and which on some levels influences us subconsciously in ways that our conscious mind and our conscious choice of a religion and religious values may not always influence us. Let's start with some easy examples. Some of you may have heard me mention a few of these examples earlier, but this is just to sort of set the groundwork. We use certain words in English which have assumptions that are behind them. Those short phrases or those words are sometimes always in the back of our mind, even if we might not always be aware of the effect of those assumptions, in some cases the harm of those assumptions. Right? One example. We say that a person is successful. What is the first thing that comes into mind when we ask if a person is successful? It's something materialistic. That materialism might not only be income or money, but it might be political success, it might be influence or power. Generally, it's money, but it's certainly going to be something materialistic. And it's not just the word success, the word worth. We use that expression very frequently. How much is that person worth? Has nothing to do with what they've done, or what their goals are, or what their values are. How much they're worth is something that you can fill in with purely a number. It is a figure of essence, of money. And that's one example. There are some more insidious examples as well. In some cases, we find that they have even influenced our expectations of our religion and our religious institutions. Let me actually leave that thought, and I'll come back to it after I've developed it a little bit. But there are some examples of these types of assumptions that come from a secular culture which influence our evaluation and our expectations of our religious institutions. Leave that thought, inshallah. We will return to it in my talk and then also in questions. I want to first discuss one other question. There is a very strong influence of popular culture that sometimes, for many Muslims, seems to be an almost unstoppable force. And in some cases, we find that our societies or our larger communities, they tend to be passive and they tend to be reactive towards those assumptions, because we really cannot conceive of another form of organizing society, or another form of thought. Let me give you an example. Probably the most glaring example that I can think of in the United States in recent history is that of gay rights. Right? That is an issue that has certainly affected the Muslim community in the sense that many Muslims are confused about the Islamic stance on the issue. Many Muslims might wonder not just about what the proper Islamic stance is in and of itself, what should I believe as a Muslim, but what position should I take within society? And you're familiar with that argument that many Muslim organizations use. Recently, the largest Sunni organization in America, I believe ISNA, has announced that they have no objection to marriage equality laws that have been passed in many states. That question that many Muslim individuals and organizations confront is, we might have our own principles and our own values, but they only make sense for people who follow our religion. And we are not in a country that is governed by our religion. And so if I personally think that it is a sin, for example, to commit blasphemy against the Prophet of Islam or any other prophet, that doesn't mean that I should advocate for any restriction on freedom of speech in the United States. It's one thing for me to speak about what I believe as a Muslim, but given that I live in a non-Islamic society, I should support freedom of speech, even if it means freedom for a person to commit blasphemy. Other examples are with gay rights, for example. Another example is abortion. Many people say that I might personally be opposed to abortion. I wouldn't want to be in a situation where I make that decision, but I would not consider myself to have the right to impose it on somebody else. So this type of a distinction. It's very common for Muslims living in this society to think that the march of, say, gay rights, the march of free speech, the march of many of these other civil rights, as they are understood and as they are defined within the West, this is unstoppable, or perhaps even natural, and that our position as Muslims is something which is against the default. And this is a problem, because even before a person actually examines a particular issue, you've already set yourself up for failure, for the Islamic position, or the position of any other religion. It is taken as being wrong without having any reason for that determination. And that is where we need to begin. At the very least, understand our assumptions and justify the assumption of what is a default or a natural position. Let me make that a little bit more clear. I want to give a clear example, I think, that all of us can relate to. It's from a slightly different field. When you look at histories of Islam that are written by non-Muslim authors, in many cases, they will give you a natural explanation, a historical and material explanation of many events in Islamic history. And in some cases, that explanation is A, very different from what a Muslim may have learned in their Islamic school or from their parents, and B, it seems to make sense. And so that becomes then the default narrative, and that the Islamic narrative is put in a defensive position. What's an example? An example is when we have traditions or ahadith or sayings attributed to the Prophet, attributed to the Imams, that give a prophecy. Now, the Muslim explanation of that is that it might be false. People can make something up. And Islamic scholarship has always recognized the existence of false hadith. But Muslims say that the Prophet was a prophet, and the Prophet did receive revelation. And so there might very well be a prophecy which is true. Not every prophecy needs to be explained in terms of some political force or somebody who wanted to make it up. And then we have to have an explanation of who inserted it into Islamic literature 100 years later or 200 years later. From an Islamic perspective, we're not going to be gullible or superstitious. We recognize that there are many parts of our books of hadith and books of tafsir and any other part of Islamic scholarship which need critical examination. But as a matter of principle, we don't say that every prophecy is wrong. The Prophet was a prophet. Sometimes people give economic or natural explanations of the success of Islam. That the Arab tribes, for example, had a proper population explosion. They were expanding out of Hijaz anyway, and Islam kind of got carried on the back of that explanation. And it might seem like that material explanation makes sense. And it might seem to a Muslim that that reduces the miraculous aspect of Islam. But from a Muslim perspective, we have always believed that God operates in the material world and He operates through material means, but that there is a purpose beyond that material operation. And so it might very well be the case that there was a population explosion and that there were social factors and that there were political factors behind the explosion of Hijaz and Arabia into the Near East. But that doesn't come at the expense of the divine, religious, spiritual explanation. My point in giving these examples is to say that it is an ideological position to say that material explanations are all there is. Just as it is an ideological position to say that there is a God who is causing events in history to unfold in this way. Both of them are ideological perspectives. Both of them are a claim. The belief that there can be a prophecy and that there isn't going to be any prophecy. And anybody who claims to have an event that was foretold, somebody made it up later on. That is also an ideological perspective. If we start out by saying one is the default, then what we are doing is we are preferencing one ideological perspective over another. And if we want to do that, we should have some justification. And so if somebody comes and tells you that Nostradamus has a whole bunch of prophecies, you might want to reject Nostradamus' prophecies, or the clairvoyant who has a shop down the street. You might want to reject their prophecies. But you want to have a reason for rejecting it. And there might very well be another situation where you will accept it. We shouldn't allow the hegemony to exist in a way that privileges a material explanation of history or of religion or a source for our values and our identity. If we want to reject a religious or an Islamic explanation for history, if we want to reject a divine source of values, then that needs to be justified. A person should have to feel a need to justify it and not say, well, that's default, that's being objective. My point is to say that in the West, we often think the way the West studies or the way that universities study Islam, that's objective. If you go to an Islamic seminary or an Islamic source, the way they study Islam is prejudiced. My point is they're both prejudiced. The difference is that the Islamic seminary is honest about its prejudices. Because an Islamic scholar will say, I believe in this religion, This is my ideology. And my scholarship is going to be on the basis of this ideology and these beliefs. And because the person is upfront about it, you can reject it. And so you can have a conversation between an Islamic scholar from a traditional Islamic seminary and a Christian scholar from a Christian seminary or a follower of another religion on equal terms. Because both of them are aware and honest and upfront about their ideology and their position. The problem comes from universities, where there is a hegemony, where there is a claim that what we are doing is objective. We have the right to discuss and analyze and talk about all of these other traditional sources of learning, because we have a higher discourse. We are being objective. It's not objective. It's a material position, and you need to justify the use of material explanations and the exclusion of spiritual explanations before you can give precedence to that explanation. Is the point clear? The conversation between Islamic scholarship or other forms of traditional scholarship and the West is not on equal terms. Because unlike Islamic scholarship, Western scholarship often is not expressed in ways that are self-aware and upfront about their ideological perspective. Okay? I hope that example was clear and somewhat understandable, but now I want to give some concrete examples of how that affects us culturally. How that affects us on a much more immediate level. I want to begin with rationality. That's one of the main features of Western thought since the time of the Enlightenment and after the Enlightenment into modernity. Islam has always had the position that religion is not purely or even primarily an intellectual exercise. It is something that encompasses every faculty of your being. But every part of your existence and every part of your being, in its own way and form, will guide you towards Allah. Your fitra, your creational disposition, the way that you have been created, and every human being has been created, will guide a person towards God. Some people who are smart in the traditional sense, book smart, they might find it easier to understand Allah and His attributes better through the use of their intellect and their analysis and their reasoning. Many of us, we find it easier to do so through the use of other faculties. Our emotion, our intuition, our sense of beauty and aesthetics, all of these faculties, they also will guide us towards Allah. Rationality, in this sense, where it is seen as something separate from a complete human soul, is actually a disease. And it actually results and will encourage secularism and atheism. Because if you approach religion purely on an intellectual level, purely on a rational level, without any spirit, without any feeling, without any emotion, without the rest of the faculties of our existence, then it is possible to intellectually prove that God exists. For most people, though, they won't understand the proof. And if some smart philosopher comes and says, This proof has a fallacy, it's wrong. A person might not be able to really understand what is right or what is wrong about that theorem, about that argument for the existence of God. And so the natural result is that a person will not be able to be so sure that God exists. Right? And then it enters the realm of a question. It enters the realm of something that needs to be proven. The important point that I want to make here is that as Muslims, we should differentiate between two types of things. There are some things that don't make sense to us because we don't understand them. And there are other things that don't make sense to us because we understand that they are wrong. If I say something which is clearly unjust, if I say go and take every innocent person in the U.S. criminal justice system, every innocent person who has been in prison, and just give them the death penalty, that won't make sense to you because you know that it's wrong. If I say something which might be a very harsh punishment for a crime that does exist, you might not be able to say so clearly that this is wrong. It might not make sense because you don't see the wisdom behind it. There's two different types of issues that conflict with our reason and our rationality, our intellect. One type is that we cannot reconcile it with our intellect. The other type is that we recognize that there might be more to the story, but we don't know what it is. If I see, as Musa alayhi salam, for example, saw Prophet Khidr or Khidr putting to death somebody, we could think, well, there might be a reason for that person to deserve death. There might not be. He seems innocent to us. So which type of a conflict with our intellect is that? Something that we know to be wrong, or something that we're not quite sure why it's right? The second type. If there's somebody that I know is innocent, has not committed a crime, and then somebody puts them to death for that crime, that is the first type. It's wrong because it conflicts with what we know to be right. The challenge that we as Muslims have is to recognize that a large number of the things that we think to belong to the first group, that don't make sense, and we say that they don't make sense because they're wrong, they might actually belong to the second group. They might not make sense to us because we don't actually know as much as we think we know. There might be many other dimensions and many benefits, even to practices and to laws and to things which we don't immediately appreciate. Not everything within Islam is meant to immediately make sense to every individual and at every time. So one of the main things that Islam wants us to be able to do with our intellect is to convert many things which we think conflict with our reason because we haven't thought it through, and to understand that it's more a question mark than an objection. And then to try to work through those questions. These are the types of issues that many people have used to circumscribe religion, to limit religion, to move from a religious sensibility to a secular sensibility. So secularism, where it comes from, is oftentimes too much confidence and too much trust in our own thinking and our own intellect. And so we see a conflict between God's commandments or between religion and our own understanding, where in many cases that conflict may not exist, or where a proper and a better reaction would be to go back into contemplation and to think about things more deeply. So one issue that we need to think about, we need to discuss, is the role of the intellect. How much trust should I place in my own intellect? And how quick should I be to second guess or to question certain teachings of Islam or certain practices of the religion that don't make sense to me? At the very least, let us begin by examining every time I say that this law doesn't make sense. Why is chess haram according to some scholars? It doesn't make any sense. At the very least, to convert it from saying that that doesn't make sense to saying I'm not quite sure what the wisdom is. A more humble formulation of the question. Let's move on, and inshallah then we will return to some of these same issues. Related to rationality is a major disease of modern societies and secular societies, and that is viewing things purely in material terms. Now, how many of you have heard of General Giap, who died recently in Vietnam? I thought that was maybe a better example. For those of you who haven't heard of General Giap, he died at a ripe old age, I think in his ninth decade, somewhere above 90 years of age. He was involved in the Vietnam War from the other side, defending his country from US attack. He died, I think, in October of this year, just a few months ago. And if you go back in a lot of newspapers, you'll find articles about his life and struggles. And very admired person, obviously, within Vietnam. But if you look at the articles that came just a few months ago in English language press, there is a certain condescension towards this person. A certain form of looking down on this person. Why? Because in defending his country against a US attack, he let millions of his own people die. Right? Now it's kind of ironic to see, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post write an obituary about a person who was defending his country from US attack, and the country that was actually sending those bombs and killing those millions of people, saying that this general was not smart enough to surrender and save his people from getting killed. Right? But that's the irony of a material society. A materialist society will naturally only be able to attach value to material things. A society that understands that it has a soul, that it has a spirit, not only does each individual have a spirit and a soul, but that each of our individual souls create a community, and that community is real, and that community has a life, that society may be able to appreciate the value of even sacrificing a million lives in order to save its independence, in order to save its communal existence. Now, that same example that I gave from Vietnam, you will find a common example or a common objection to the events of the Iranian Revolution. People will say that what kind of leadership was it? What kind of stone heart did Imam Khomeini have where he let hundreds of thousands of people go to their death? In some cases, young children, teenagers, 14, 15-year-old, who would be considered children by our modern legal definition. How did he let those people go to their death? That objection, it comes because of materialism. It comes because that person making the objection can only see value in life, in the physical and the material existence of a person. And the death penalty seems to be wrong by default. Any type of sacrificing of life needs a monumental justification in order for it to make sense. And even then, it doesn't really make sense. There's an internal contradiction in sacrificing your life if the only thing that exists is a material society. It's a separate point. The point that I want to make and that I want to focus on is that this is something which we as Muslims are going to have to deal with in raising our families, in creating our communities. Our society is a material society, and it gives a great deal of value to the material preservation of life. By doing so, it actually cheapens life, because a purely material life is not worth living. But when that exists, it makes it very difficult to try to live a religious life or raise a religious family. So far, we have rationalism, or the overemphasis on the intellect. We have materialism, only being able to evaluate things, a person's success, or the priorities of a society in material terms, a perennial debate about whether we should compromise our principles in order to improve our economic position. Right? If you cut corners as an individual, you can often make a lot more money than if you don't cut corners. Countries and societies in the same way, if they compromise on certain principles, they can benefit their GDP, their bottom line. How should we make those decisions? How should our societies make those decisions? The challenge that we have is to escape from that materialism. Two more things that I want to mention. Number one is individualism. We have that message in our society. This is one of those insidious things that we often don't realize. I am my own person. I am an individual. That I, as an individual, have certain rights. Islam firmly stands against the emphasis on our individuality. Our individuality, in reality, is a source for our constructive engagement and interaction with all of those relationships that exist within our creation. From an Islamic perspective, a person who sees him or herself as an individual is a person who does not believe in Tawheed. Because Tawheed tells us that we have a single creator, we have a purpose in our life, and that creator created us in a certain place, at a certain time, in order to move towards him, to move towards salvation, to move towards perfection. And so we have to make use of all of those resources and all of those elements of our existence. When we focus on our individuality, we are in reality preventing ourselves from doing that. And then the fourth thing that I want to mention as a challenge of modernity is state institutions. If you look at the recent history of the Muslim world, and I'm speaking of the last few generations, what we have is the fragmentation of our natural affinity to our fellow members of the Muslim Ummah. It was very common, even up till 20, 30 years ago, for people in the Muslim community to feel a natural identity with every other member of the Muslim Ummah as somebody who had rights over me and a relationship with me. And that is something that has certainly been shaken in the recent past. If you look at, for example, in Egypt, in the last few years since the Arab Spring erupted in Cairo and went through its ups and downs, there is certainly a push by many people, many of whom are Muslims, to view that in an Egyptian prison. That is something which is a relatively new issue in many parts of the Muslim world. And that is a result of modernity. It used to be said, politically speaking, that most Muslim countries are weak states. They are weak states because they have tribal loyalties, they have linguistic loyalties, and so people in Pakistan, for example, are Punjabis, or they're Sindhis, or they're Balochis. They're not Pakistanis, first and foremost. People in Syria, for example, they have an affinity with their religion, with their school of thought, with their tribe, with their regions, but not necessarily a very strong identity as a Syrian. And so on and so forth throughout the Muslim world. In some places more, in some places less of a factor. And this was often seen as a weak point of the Muslim world. And now that some of those state identities have staying power, many non-Muslim observers are impressed. We didn't think Iraq was going to survive this many years after the end of Saddam Hussein's rule. Now, it might not have survived in an ideal situation, but the survival of the state itself and the existence of an Iraqi identity is something that has impressed a lot of people. But if it's impressed non-Muslims, it certainly raises the question for a Muslim that why is it impressive? What does it mean for me to be an Iraqi or a Pakistani or a Syrian or a Bahraini and to have an identity and to strengthen a state that is not something that I have chosen and that certainly doesn't represent my values and my principles? It's an accident of my birth. My citizenship, my ethnicity, all of these things, they are accidents of my birth. That's not to deny their importance. That's not to say that we want to erase those borders. But it certainly is a challenge as a Muslim if we believe that what is of primary importance is our values. What do we do with these state institutions? Is it the job of a Muslim to try to deny or erase these state boundaries? When they have been erased, we see that what has often resulted is something tragic. Syria is perhaps the best example. The weakening of the state has certainly not resulted in a utopia of a Muslim society or an ideal state for the Muslim world. And many of us would probably say, rightfully and with justification, that to end the violence and the insecurity and the terrorism, the Syrian state needs to be strengthened. And when there is similar violence in other parts of the Muslim world, to end that, those institutions, they need to be strengthened. Fine. As a temporary or as a stopgap solution, we need to strengthen those institutions. But what about our identity as a Muslim Ummah? Where does that lead our values and our principles as a formative point of our identity? If we put that on hold, then are we ever going to be able to establish that security and establish that peace and then Each Muslim country will be pursuing its interests and pursuing its economic well-being, and what is going to then allow us to bring back to importance our values and our religious identity and create a single Muslim Ummah. So these are four different areas that I would like us to think about. Our individual identity, that is our main identity in a secular society. And Islam is very strongly opposed to me seeing myself primarily as an individual or primarily as somebody who has rights. I have rights, but the rights are balanced by responsibilities. And if I have to choose one, which is more important, the rights or the responsibilities, which is more important? Responsibilities. Because those rights have only been given to us to the extent that Allah has allowed us to exercise them, to the extent that He has given us permission to move and to act freely within the world. Even before we had any permission to do anything, and Allah allowed us to do certain things, we had a responsibility to Him just by virtue of being a creation of Allah. So that anything, the responsibilities come first. The second is our rationality, putting it in its proper place and not seeing it as being something that is the major part of our existence or our identity. Materialism and counteracting the effects of living in a material society. And then thinking about what we can do with these institutions that exist, state institutions and all of the institutions that come with them, that are essential to the modern world, because you have to have a citizenship, you have to be a member of your society. And the question that we have is, how do we maintain this identity? In some cases, in the case of a state identity, we may even need as Muslims to strengthen it in order to preserve life, in order to preserve peace and security. But at the same time, we need to transcend it. So those are the four issues that I would like us to examine. And inshallah, I will open it up for your comments and for your questions. And in the end, inshallah, I will conclude with a few concrete principles of what it is that we can do to preserve and strengthen our Islamic identity. Something, inshallah, that we can take home in order to try to inoculate ourselves, protect ourselves from this society that has such fundamental disagreement with our values and our principles.